This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. By the narrowest of margins, the North Carolina legislature last week overrode Governor Bev Perdue's veto of a bill enacting some of the most stringent regulations of abortion in the nation. Starting this fall, women seeking a termination will have to wait 24 hours and receive state-mandated counseling. And doctors will have to show patients an ultrasound of the fetus and describe it to them. In a few minutes, we're going to take a look at the effects of the law on the medical practice in the state, some of the legal challenges it might face, and where it falls in the broader history of family planning debates in this country. But first, let's find out exactly what's in the law and how it came to pass. On the line is Laura Leslie, Capital Bureau Chief for WRAL-TV. Laura, welcome back.
Hey, Frank.
Tell us about this bill, now a law. What's in it?
Well, essentially, it's called the Woman's Right to Know Act. And essentially, as you said, it requires that 24-hour waiting period before an abortion. And at least 24 hours in advance, the doctor has to tell the patient about his qualifications, his or her qualifications as doctor, what other options are available, and the fact that he or she will be offered this ultrasound. And then at least 4 hours before the procedure, but no more than 3 days before the procedure, they have to undergo an ultrasound. And the patient has to be offered the opportunity to look at the screen while the provider narrates what he's seeing or she is seeing in terms of the external features, the number of fetuses, the positioning in the womb. The woman has the right to avert her eyes from the screen under the law, and I guess she can just not listen if she doesn't want to hear, but the doctor has to say this to her. And if she chooses not to look at the image, she has to sign a piece of paper saying that, and the doctor is going to keep that piece of paper on file for 7 years. Another big part of this has to do with the information that the doctor is required to give the woman, and that includes information about the fact that food stamps and welfare are available to help her raise her child if she chooses to do that, and that the father of the child can be sued for child support if she chooses to do that, and some other options for if she would like to choose another option, like adoption, for example, or keeping the baby. Now, you know, what we're hearing a lot of from the medical side of things, which I'm sure you're going to get into more down the road, is that basically the state is dictating what a doctor has to say to a patient, to every patient, whether she's 10 years old or 40, no matter what her circumstances are, and no matter what the doctor thinks it's best that she know.
So she's being counseled that there are social services available, that there's money available from the state for support, including medical services, food stamps. 72-hour period. Now, tell us a little bit more about that. And if there's an ultrasound, if the abortion isn't performed within 72 hours after the ultrasound, then will there have to be another one and you go through the process all over again?
Yes, that's how that works. It has to be within 3 days in the file. So basically, the idea is to have the woman look at the image and listen to the narration and the information, and then have time to think about it before she undergoes the procedure.
24 hours.
Well, yeah, a minimum of 4 for the ultrasound, maximum of 72.
All right. Now, the law gives standing to a wide range of people who can sue a doctor for violations. Is that right?
Yes, and this is interesting that, you know, basically under this new law, you're the siblings or the parent of a patient or the patient's current or even former childhood doctor would have the right to sue if a doctor performed an abortion on that patient without following each and every one of these requirements in the law. The father of the fetus would also have standing to sue regardless of whether or not the woman was voluntarily impregnated, although people who support the bill say that there are other state laws that would eventually, that would effectively keep a rapist or somebody like, or, you know, an incestuous parent from being able to bring suit on behalf of that fetus.
How are the mandatory ultrasounds going to be paid for?
That's a good question. A lot of abortion procedures apparently already involve ultrasounds, especially those that are paid for through private insurance or out of pocket. Some of the ones performed in nonprofit clinics, I know in a lot of places they're considered standard procedure. In other places, they're not. So basically, the woman would have to pay for the ultrasound in those situations. Now, the arguments that were made in committee are that there are places where you can get a free ultrasound in many areas of the state. And, for example, crisis pregnancy centers often offer free ultrasounds. But if you're familiar with crisis pregnancy centers, of course, that's a pro-life group that strives to keep women from having abortions. And so people who are critics of this bill say that that will basically subject the woman who can't afford her own ultrasound to go through a big guilt trip in order to get a free ultrasound from one of these places.
This was a busy year. State is in a financial crisis. The budget and finances were an important topic and certainly took center stage. How was it that a bill like this even found its way onto the schedule?
Well, you know, there are certain topics that were on the agenda for the new Republican leadership, and they, you know, made that clear from the beginning. And this was one of them. You know, Republicans have been trying for a long time to get a waiting period, at least on abortion in North Carolina. This is one of several bills that you could say don't really have a lot to do with the budget or jobs or other fiscal issues, but that are nonetheless important to the folks who are now in the charge of the legislature.
Recap for us about the how the veto overrides happened. It was very close, and it's, there were points along the way when it looked like the override might not happen.
Yeah, it was very close. The bill passed. It just got the exact number of votes it needed in each chamber. In the House, they picked up four Democrats who it's not unusual for these four people to vote with the Republicans on some issues, and these are more conservative Democrats, and they decided to vote for the override in this case. On the Senate side, it was a little tougher because there were two. The Senate has 31 Republicans. They need 30 votes to override a veto. But there are these two Republicans who did not vote for the bill when it came through. One was Senator Richard Stevens of Wake County, who was absent actually during the veto override. The other, who actually voted against the vote the first time, the bill, was Senator Stan Bingham from Davidson County. And Senator Bingham has a daughter who's a doctor, and he voted against the bill the first time. But when it came down to the veto override, he decided to not take part. He did not want to vote for the bill. But basically he said, you know, it was communicated to him by his caucus that he needed to get out of the way. So by his leaving the chamber that day and by Stevens being absent, it lowered the number of votes that the Republicans needed for that override to 29, which is exactly how many they had. So folks who are angry with Bingham right now, and there are apparently quite a few, are saying that even though he walked away, in essence what he did cast that final vote because it made it possible for that veto to be overridden.
And yet he objected. What were his objections?
Well, his objections to it were, like, he'd raised four independent daughters, and he said he didn't think the state ought to be telling them what to do. And as I said, one of his daughters, I believe, is a doctor. And, you know, basically he just felt that this was not an appropriate, place for the government to intervene between a patient and a doctor. But, again, when it came down to being a caucus issue, you know, he was under pressure, we assume, and he left the building before the vote.
And what was the main argument for this law?
Well, the argument is that women need to have all the information available to them before they decide to have an abortion. And, you know, some people the supporters of the bill said that some women are coerced into this or are not given the information, perhaps by people who want them to have the abortion because it's more convenient for them, like the father of a child or parents. They want to make sure that the woman going into this has time to think about it, realizes what she's doing, and can actually consider what her alternatives might be. They also say that some patients are not given the information that they need by the doctor, although the state does, in fact, have informed consent laws that require a doctor to give you the risks and benefits of every procedure and alternatives if that's appropriate. So it's not that they weren't already required to do that, but some people say doctors weren't doing it in the case of abortion.
What has Governor Perdue's response been?
Governor Perdue vetoed this, and was unhappy about the override, obviously. She just feels like it goes too far. And some other folks do, too. I mean, you know, a lot of the Democrats and even a couple of the Republicans said that they would have liked to have seen some exception given in cases of rape or incest or cases where the mother's life is in danger. You know, there are other concerns about parents who very much want to have a baby, but the fetus has medical problems that won't let it be born, or it won't survive long after birth, and so they make this difficult decision to terminate this pregnancy, and then they have to go through all of this anyway, you know, which they...
Including the ultrasound and seeing the
and
ultrasound.
And the narration and all of that, yeah. So, you know, that's some concerns that were voiced by some Democrats. So, I mean, there are similar laws to this. In Texas, for example, has a similar law with the ultrasound viewing in it. But in Texas, there are exceptions made in cases of rape or incest or in case of, you know, the life of the mother.
And you talked to lawmakers, even supporters of this law, who acknowledged that there are some difficulties with the language and maybe it was a little too stringent.
Yeah, you know, a couple of people have said after the fact that, well, maybe we should have had an exception in it. But, you know, it's a little disingenuous to have voted for the bill and then to say that it needed to be fixed. This bill was in progress from, I think, February or March at some point. It certainly didn't pop up in the final days of session. So it got a lot of discussion. It had a lot of committee hearings. I was there for all of them. A lot of public testimony, a lot of debate on both floors. So, you know, the idea that it was, you know, pass it first and fix it later, you know, and it's not like that never happens around here, of course, but it seems a little disingenuous to me.
When does the law go into effect?
90 days from the time that the veto was overridden. So it'll be late October.
And what about the possible legal challenges?
Well, the Center for Reproductive Rights is looking at it. They're actually a pro-choice group who is challenging similar laws in Oklahoma and Texas. And they say that it is unconstitutional to require a woman to listen to government-mandated speech in the privacy of her doctor's office. Now, of course, whether or not the courts agree with them, we don't know yet. You know, but they say that they're having a look at the North Carolina law to see whether or not that, too, could be sort of brought into that court case to find out whether or not the state can, in fact, make you listen to something that you don't want to hear.
And we will hear more about that in just a moment. In the meantime, let me thank you, Laura Leslie.
Thanks a lot.
Laura Leslie, Capitol Bureau Chief for WRAL-TV. Just ahead, one of the primary Senate sponsors of the bill joins us. We get a medical and legal view of how the law will work in practice. On the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Today, talking about North Carolina's new abortion law. It requires a woman to wait 24 hours, receive counseling, be shown an ultrasound of the fetus. And joining us now to discuss the law and its potential effects are B.B. Anderson, senior counsel at the Center for Reproductive Rights, involved in the legal challenge to a similar law in Texas. State Senator Warren Daniel is one of the primary sponsors of the new North Carolina law, and Dr. Charles Monteith is medical director of Planned Parenthood of Central North Carolina. I want to welcome all of you to the program. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
Good afternoon.
Thank you.
B.B. Anderson, let me start with you. What are the main legal challenges that you see to a law like this?
Well, at this point, as mentioned, the Center for Reproductive Rights is looking carefully at the North Carolina law, and we certainly have serious concerns about it. We're currently challenging two laws that have some significant similarities to North Carolina's new law. One is in Oklahoma, and one is in Texas. In both the Oklahoma and the Texas laws, mandate the provision of an ultrasound for every woman before she have an abortion, and also both of those laws mandate that a description of the ultrasound image be provided and that the images be displayed where the woman put into her view, so the woman has those displays in her view. Those are similarities to the North Carolina law. There are some differences in terms of how long before the procedure the abortion must be performed. But in both Oklahoma and in Texas, we are challenging the constitutionality of those laws. In Oklahoma, we're in state court, challenging under the state constitution. We have been successful in getting that law preliminarily enjoined, so though it was passed a year ago, it has not gone into effect. In Texas, the law is not scheduled to go into effect yet. We have filed a motion for a preliminary injunction. Final briefing on that motion is happening right now in federal court, and we are hoping certainly that the court will issue its decision before the effective date of that Texas law.
What about the North Carolina law?
North Carolina, we're looking carefully at, as I say, it has some of the exact same problems that the Oklahoma and Texas laws have. You know, as with those two states' laws, this law really intrudes into the physician-patient relationship and does so to advance an anti-choice agenda, you know, by dictating what the abortion provider must say to the woman. That really violates principles of medical ethics, where the doctor is supposed to take into account the individual patient and provide information and respect the individual patient's view as to what information she feels she needs for her decision. This North Carolina law really hijacks that relationship and inserts the government right in between.
Why would that be unconstitutional?
Well, one of the things that the law is doing, one of the problems that we've seen in Oklahoma and Texas laws as well, is that it's forcing the abortion provider to provide the government's speech. It's forcing speech into the mouths of the physician who's going to perform the abortion. And that really raises serious First Amendment concerns. under both in Oklahoma state constitution and in Texas under the, we've pointed out, the federal constitutional problems with that. And when you have this physician-patient private relationship, to have the government insert itself into that and force into the physician's mouth what must be told to the woman, that really, again, as I say, raises serious First Amendment concerns.
Senator Daniel, what about that? Generally, Republicans are opposed to state interference, government telling people what to do. Should we be worried about the constitutionality of this law?
No, Frank, I don't think so. I mean, I think first we need to refocus on the fact that two human beings walk into an abortion clinic and one walks out. We need to refocus on the fact that one life is being terminated in an abortion procedure. You know, one of the things that I focused on in my floor debate was that there are many other areas of the law where before an individual can exercise a right, they have to go through a waiting period. Two of the, you know, the examples that I brought out on the floor were, one, if you want to seek a divorce in North Carolina, you have to wait for a whole year before you can petition for a divorce. You know, why is that? It's because we value the marriage relationship and we want to give people an opportunity to reconcile their marriages. The second is if you want to refinance your house, well, you come into a lawyer's office, you sign the papers, and then you have to wait 3 days before you can get your refinance loan. And the purpose of that is we don't want lending institutions taking advantage of people, and we don't want homeowners making bad financial decisions. Those are just two examples. You know, a year for a divorce, 3 days for refinance. We think that 24 hours and providing some information is very reasonable in an abortion procedure when you're terminating a human life.
Dr. Monteith, let's step back a minute and take a look at the practical implications of this bill for somebody in your position. You work in the clinic every day. How is this going to change what you do every day?
Well, Frank, before I start, I'd just like to say, when I first started teaching residents and students about OBGYN, I was proud to be a North Carolina citizen. I was proud of it because North Carolina passed a far-reaching abortion law before Roe v. Wade. This law takes us back 40 years, and it endangers the life of North Carolina women. Currently at Planned Parenthood, we have patients. They check in. Every patient gets an ultrasound. No patient comes through our facility without getting an ultrasound if they're seeking a pregnancy termination. These women are offered to look at the screen while the ultrasound is being done. Their response is recorded. These women are asked before the ultrasound is done if they want to know if they have twins or more, and that is recorded. And this is all recorded in the chart. The patient then goes through an extensive informed consent session, one-on-one. The patient ultimately then goes back for a procedure. The doctor reviews a chart. The doctor then asks the patients if they have any questions, and then the woman's choice is upheld.
That was all before the new law?
Correct.
So what changes now for you? How are things different?
Frankly, we don't know. We're working on that right now, and we're trying to figure that out. It's going to be tough, and things are going to be different. We are trying very hard to maintain a one-on-one relationship with the patient. But the way this law is set up, especially with that second ultrasound having to be done and those patients having to wait an additional 4 hours, that is kind of crafting a situation where patients might actually be herded into a clinic just like they're trying to prevent, and it's just going to make it worse for North Carolina citizens.
How so?
With this second ultrasound, those people are going to have to come. They're going to have to get that ultrasound. And then they're going to have to wait 4 hours. And they're going to have to do that with everyone else who is seeking to uphold their choice that day. And that's just going to create an extremely uncomfortable environment for these patients.
What about that, Senator Daniel, that in effect we're not giving women so much the time to think about it as pressuring them to make a decision because there are so many obstacles. I have to come back. It's just too much. Senator Daniel?
Well, I think that's the point of the law, is to ensure that women who are considering the abortion alternative, that they receive, you know, all the information associated with an abortion, its alternatives, the risks, and they'll be given non-judgmental, scientifically accurate medical facts about the development of the child before making a permanent decision. You know, in other states, and there are around 30 other states that have similar laws to the North Carolina law, you know, it's been statistically shown that abortion rates are reduced by as much as 10%, which would result in North Carolina in about 3,000 additional citizens being born in North Carolina every year. You know, obviously, I know, you know, Planned Parenthood is the largest abortion provider in the United States, and, you know, this, you know, this can reduce their market share.
B.B. Anderson, let me ask you about something Senator Daniel said earlier. Look, there are waiting periods for a lot of procedures that we do because we want people to have time to really think about it and make sure that they're giving thought to a very important decision.
Well, that's one of the other big concerns that this law raises, is that the whole premise is that women are not thinking about their decision. And that really is based on outdated stereotypes that, you know, women are too immature or they're incompetent to make important decisions. A woman seeking an abortion has thought about her decision. She understands what it means to obtain an abortion. This law seems to be premised on the idea that women seek abortions without that knowledge, without any thought, and that therefore they have to have this additional waiting period imposed on them by the state, this beyond whatever period the woman has taken to make her decision. And to compare it to refinancing the house or divorce totally, again, ignores the woman and ignores the situation. This is a medical procedure that's time sensitive, and the law needs to recognize that, and the law needs to respect women and respect their ability to make choices. And as noted earlier in the program, medical providers are under a professional and legal obligation already to provide information about alternatives and risks of any medical procedure, and that's true in the abortion context as in with other medical care. And for the state to impose these special requirements on this procedure that women seek is really, again, based on this view of women. No such imposition is made on men seeking medical care related to their reproductive choices.
Dr. Monteith, does this impinge in a different way on the doctor-patient relationship? Is there something unethical about this? As you said, you're already doing some of this, and I believe some of it's mandated. In a pure legal sense or an ethical sense, is there anything categorically different in this law?
I think to make a patient wait when they potentially have a life-threatening situation is unethical. I think me, as a physician, when I have to give a state-mandated script to a woman that has a lethal fetal anomaly, who's already been through a maternal fetal medicine specialist, who's already had an extensive workup, knows what the outcome of that pregnancy is going to be, for me to have to go through a state-mandated script again, I don't believe in that.
You know, the question of exception, Senator Daniel, has come up, and one of the objections to this bill is that, or the law, I should say, is that there are no exceptions. And in fact, one of your colleagues, Republican Senator Jim Davis, was asked by WTVD if there should have been exceptions. Let's listen.
I think that there are some parts of that bill that maybe could have been drafted a little bit better, a little less onerous maybe.
Senator Daniels, should there be exceptions?
Well, there is an exception. It already has a medical emergency exception in the bill. I guess I don't really recall a rape and incest exception being proposed in committee.
But if I have an anomaly, if for instance, if a woman is in danger herself or if there's a fetal anomaly, she'll have to go through this one, perhaps two times to see this the fetus again. In other states, there are exceptions for this, apparently not in North Carolina.
Well, as I said, this bill has a medical emergency exception, so I'm not sure exactly what the doctor was referring to. But there is a medical exception for emergencies.
You talked about the there will be probably 10% fewer abortions. I saw one estimate of 3,000. And one of the counseling points is that women will receive some kind of social services. Now, the legislature cut spending in public health, cut spending in education. Those are all social services that new young lives rely on. Will there be an increase in spending in social services to provide for the new lives in North Carolina?
Well, just, you know, to go back to the reduction, the 10% reduction estimate, I mean, I think to some degree that proves our point that when you give women accurate information and additional information about the procedure and the risks and the future medical problems that you might encounter, that the information persuades some women that the best choice for her is not to abort her child. This is a pro-choice law. It's about giving women the most information that they can have before they make an informed choice.
Will the social services money follow? They're being counseled that it's available. It's been cut, could be cut again. Will there be more money provided for the new lives in this state?
Well, the fiscal note on this bill estimated that the costs annually of the additional births would impact the Medicaid system by somewhere around $6 to $7 million. The interesting other fact is that it also estimated that there would be a reduction in medical costs in the range of $35 million for future births of other women that these women would go on to have. Post-abortion live births have more medical problems associated because of the prior abortion. So there was actually a net gain, if you want to look at it in that way.
Public education, other social services.
Well, public education is just, schools are paid for on a per-student basis, and if there's more students, then there'll be more funds provided to that school to educate them.
But funding,
I think that's a great problem, actually.
Yeah,
more citizens in North Carolina, more students. Let's find more money to educate them.
About the question, B.B. Anderson, or I guess I want to put this to you, Dr. Monteith, the question of counseling and whether or not the government script is part of the question here for you. You're already doing this. What is it? Are you actually handed a script? Are you told what to say, or you're given guidelines?
The state hasn't generated that information yet. It's supposed to be done within the next 90 days, so we really are not exactly sure of the exact wording of what we're supposed to tell patients.
And do you expect one of the things that I know Senator Daniels said is, look, if you get more time, there's a 10% reduction. This proves people have given it more thought, and on second thought and on third thought, they've actually come to a different conclusion. Given more time to think, people will make a different decision.
Frank, the women in North Carolina, they have enough time to think. They don't need any more time. Let me tell people how it works. Here's how it works. Sex happens, right? You have an event that happens, and then that woman thinks, well, gee, am I pregnant? No, I can't be pregnant. My period will come. Several days pass. Every day the person is agonizing about this, putting it off. It can't be me. Then their period doesn't come. They just still are doubting it. The next day, eventually they take a pregnancy test. It's positive. They don't believe it. They can't believe that it's true. They misread the test. The test must be wrong. They take another test, a third test, and eventually it starts to set in. They've already had at least a week or two to think about that. Most abortions in the state of North Carolina are not done unless the pregnancy can be seen on ultrasound. Pregnancy cannot be seen on ultrasound until about 7 to 14 days after a woman has missed her period. The women in North Carolina already have at least 2 weeks to think about this decision. The informed consent process is extremely important, but making women wait and delay endangers their lives. We have 90% of the counties in North Carolina don't have an abortion provider. We see people that come from the Outer Banks. Just because they don't come back and ultimately get an abortion doesn't necessarily change their mind. These are people that are in difficult social circumstances and situations. They're sometimes in dysfunctional relationships. Sometimes they just can't find a person to watch their kids, or they don't have transportation to get back to Chapel Hill. That is a reason why a lot of patients end up not coming back. This law endangers the lives of North Carolina women, and studies support that when other states have had mandatory wait laws.
Senator Daniel, what's behind the decision to, and I think this is unique to the North Carolina law, that if the abortion isn't performed within 72 hours of the ultrasound, another ultrasound has to be performed. Why?
Well, I think probably the rationale is that, this wasn't discussed in committee either, but I think the rationale would just be that the development has changed by 3 days. Let's give the woman an updated viewing of the child. And there was some mention in the early part of the conversation about, the doctor does have to sort of describe what the child looks like, and point out, details on the ultrasound. Well, that's when a woman goes to her OBGYN, that's what he or she is doing. You go in, you say, I want this child, tell me what it looks like. And they say, well, it's a boy or a girl. Here's the arms, here's the legs. So I don't think there's anything different, or onerous about the requirement for an abortion provider to show a woman a viewing of the ultrasound and point out the details of what the fetus or child looks like.
Dr. Monteith, in your experience, would that be an extra burden?
It's a tremendous burden. I'm going to tell your listeners the real reason for that second ultrasound. Turn up your volume. Patients come back, they get that second ultrasound, and then I have to give them a script of what needs to be said. And even though they have been seen earlier in the week, if it's been more than 72 hours, they have to get that ultrasound and the script has to be repeated. That woman then has to wait 4 hours, take that long walk of shame back to the waiting room and sit there with other women looking down at her feet, glancing up furtively, trying to make sure the next person that comes to that door, they don't know them or they're not recognized. And then if that waiting room becomes too crowded or there's no seats, then they have to go outside. And boys and girls, that's where the real fun starts, because it could be 100 degrees outside. It could be freezing temperatures. But when those people go outside, they are sacrificial lambs to the protesters or the wolves that are tracing the boundary of our facilities. And those people, let them have it. I mean, they are nailed to the cross with steel stakes of guilt and whipped with shame. And then they're speared in the side with the threat of eternal damnation. That's the real reason for that second ultrasound. And that is why it's in this law.
I think that's ridiculous.
We've been talking with B.B. Anderson, senior counsel with the Center for Reproductive Rights, State Senator Warren Daniel, Republican of Burke and Caldwell Counties. Dr. Charles Monteith is a medical director of Planned Parenthood in Central North Carolina. Thank all of you for joining us. Coming up, we'll broaden the discussion to look at the history and politics of family planning in America. Stay with us on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking about Women's Right to Know Act. It's a new law in North Carolina. Places severe restrictions on women seeking an abortion. The laws, regulations govern family planning in America can't be charted on a single trajectory. Access to birth control has not become steadily easier or harder. And abortion was legal in the 1800s, then it became illegal and became legal again in the 1970s. So where does the new North Carolina law fall in this convoluted history? Joining us now to help answer the questions are Carol Joffe, a professor in the Bixby Center for Global Reproductive Health at the University of California at San Francisco. She's the author of the book Dispatches from the Abortion Wars, The Cost of Fanaticism to Doctors, Patients, and the Rest of Us. And Leslie Regan is a professor of history at the University of Illinois, the author of the book When Abortion Was a Crime, Women, Medicine, and Law in the United States, 1867 to 1973. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Hi.
What does this new law say to each of you about where we are in this ever-changing zigzag trajectory in the debate over family planning in the U.S.? Leslie, let me start with you.
Well, you did a nice introduction that it is a zigzagging history. We're going backwards. I think one of the things that's most important for people to know that is surprising to many is that we have a long, long history of women seeking and obtaining abortions. I think we often think that in the Victorian era, in the 19th century, that nobody had abortions, that it's something that started in the 1960s, and it's very important for people to understand that that's not the case at all. And as you already mentioned, that actually it was legal under common law, and the word abortion actually only referred to ending a pregnancy after quickening, when a woman could feel the movement of the fetus around the third or fourth month, and that was something that women understood themselves as morally unacceptable, and it was also criminalized. And it was not until the 1860s and 1870s that there was an effort led by particular section of regular physicians, which eventually became the AMA professionals, who changed the name and started arguing that abortion was at the beginning of conception, and that that was murder, and began to equate it with infanticide, and laws passed in the states to criminalize something that had never been thought of as abortion.
Carol, what's your sense of where we are?
Where we are is... I agree with both of you. We're zigzagging and going backward. You know, what's so extraordinary about what we're seeing going on in both in North Carolina and much of the rest of the country is the explosion, I mean, really unprecedented explosion of abortion restrictions, excuse me, that have been introduced since the November 10 elections. I mean, ever since Roe, some states have tried to restrict abortion, but there's never been there's never been an explosion like we've seen since November 10 elections. I mean, after the new Congress took effect in Washington, and as many state houses and state legislatures became all red, or as in your case in North Carolina, nearly red, there's been almost 1,000 laws introduced in state legislatures since January. Now, obviously not all of them have passed, but many, like yours, have. And I think what these laws show is your previous guests demonstrated, especially the doctor from Planned Parenthood. I mean, these laws satisfy the Republican anti-abortion base, but what they do is impose enormous hardships on women. I mean, I believe his name was Monteith. Mm-hmm. Dr. Monteith's description, you know, of women standing outside on the porch in 100-degree heat with protesters bellowing at them, I mean, that's not a way to do health care in the United States in 2011. So we are at a very dispiriting place right now with respect to abortion.
Usually, though, and again, we'll use that term zigzag, things have changed. Our ideas about abortion have changed over time, back and forth. Ordinarily, there are some underlying cultural, political, sometimes economic reasons that can explain these shifts. Take us back and tell us about some of the shifts that have occurred and what has been at the root of these changes.
Well, that's important. I mean, this does remind me of the, you know, 1860s, 70s, when abortion's criminalized, when birth control, I mean, there had been an open period of discussion about free love and sex and sort of changing ideas about marriage, and you have the passage of the Comstock Law at the federal level to completely suppress discussion and availability of contraceptives, any discussion of sex and abortion, and that's equated with obscenity and the passage of these laws. And then again in the 1940s, we have an incredible suppression of abortion and abortion clinics, which had been really open in the 1930s, very available. And I would say these are associated with, you know, a larger suppression of sexuality, incredible backlash and anxiety about changes in gender and women's roles in the 19th century, where women are politically active. There are, you know, upper-class women out in public, involved in the anti-slavery movement, involved in the temperance movement and telling men what to do, you know, stop drinking, trying to enter medical school in the 40s, obviously out in the workforce, and then after the war trying to push women back into the home. Politics. I'm sorry, Carol, I couldn't even hear you begin, but the politics of women and the anger at what's happening and the changes in the family and gender, and I really, this is part of what we've seen. Mm. Plus, it's, of course, worked very well for the Republican Party. I mean, it helped usher in Ronald Reagan and effectively. Carol,
okay, and I would simply bring the story more into the 20th century,
yeah,
that I think, you know, one can't understand the modern anti-abortion movement without understanding the events of the 1960s and 1970s, mm-hmm, you know, the rise of feminism, not just the legalization of abortion, but the rise of a women's movement, the rise, yeah, of a gay rights movement. These movements inevitably caused a backlash, counter-movements, and Roe versus Wade became, as one colleague of mine put it, the battering ram. The many resentments, the many anxieties that Leslie spoke about occurring earlier, you know, resurfaced very strongly, you know, in the 1970s. This led to the movement then called the New Right. Today we're more likely to refer to it as the religious right. It wasn't just about abortion. It was about sex before marriage. It was about teenage pregnancy. It was about gay rights. It was about women entering the labor force. It was about anxiety about rising divorce rates. I mean, it was anxiety about all the changes in gender and sexuality that came to the fore in the 60s and 70s, but abortion was the battering ram. Abortion brought literally millions of people into a broader religious right movement.
But Carol, but abortion is in itself an important moral issue. I mean, let me.
Oh, sure.
You have in the subtitle of your book, for instance, the cost of fanaticism to doctors, patients, and the rest of us. But in fact, there are those who believe, as a strong moral conviction, that all life is sacred, that nothing trumps human life, and that frankly, there are more creative solutions to the problems of poverty and security than annihilation. And these are not extreme views, are they?
No, and I appreciate your bringing that up, and I make very, very clear in the first few pages of my book that not all those who are opposed to abortion can be considered fanatics. Certainly not all who are opposed to abortion. In fact, the vast majority of those opposed to abortion are very much against the violence that's exhibited against abortion providers. So I am glad for that clarification. However, to go to your previous point, Frank, other solutions, what is so frustrating and what is so puzzling to many is that some of the obvious solutions to the abortion rate in the United States are also opposed by those who oppose abortion. And the obvious case is contraception. One of the most strange and fascinating and puzzling facts of our current political situation is the enormous campaign against contraception. Contraception, which used to be considered, quote, common ground between those who were for abortion and those who were against it, now has become redefined by many, not all, but many in the anti-abortion movement as, quote, supportive of the abortion mentality, as itself an abortifacient. So, for example, in North Carolina as well as elsewhere, you've had cases of pharmacists refusing to fill women's prescriptions for regular birth control, for emergency contraception, claiming that these things in themselves are abortions. So the problems we face now from a, quote, pro-choice perspective are not only defending legal abortion, but defending contraception.
Also, there are also questions about whether or not there's a consistency, because those who are opposed to abortion tend also to support the death penalty and are fast to go to war. Those are other annihilating solutions to very serious problems. And then the question of whether or not you're going to pay in terms of social services
exactly.
for the cost of adding new lives.
Yeah, and these are good questions. I also think it's important to add that people who support abortion and the women who have them are not only having them for reasons of poverty. There are many reasons to have abortions. This has been true historically and in the present, that women decide that at this point in time they are not able to have a child. And I think it's also important, I mean, the attorney was talking about these laws being such insults to women in the way that they think about women's thinking. And all of these really are parenting decisions, because women are considering the seriousness of being mothers and deciding whether they can at that point, whether they are able, whether they want to be mothers, whether it's appropriate. And most people are thinking about this as part of their lifetime, you know, before they have sex, before they've had their period, you know, before they've missed the period. It's certainly not something that they just walk into a clinic kind of in this haphazard way. But there can be many reasons related to their partner, their age, the number of children they already have, jobs, all kinds of reasons. Certainly in our country, the lack of a social system that provides a floor of income where people are secure, they know they can go to school, they know they'll have the money for home and food and adequate housing and everything for themselves and their children contributes to a sense that, you know, maybe you have to have an abortion because you can't afford children. And that's something that, you know, I think contributes to it. But that is not an argument that the reproductive rights movement makes for having abortions. It was part of, you know, some of the reasons for passing liberalization of the abortion laws that came from population control and zero population movements. But I think it's really important to separate that population control kind of argument from a reproductive rights movement, and also from all the people who decide to have it.
I'm going to take you both way back a little bit, since we're looking at the historical context. To what extent do you, either of you, feel that the medicalization of birth and reproductive care contribute to this? This was once considered the province of women entirely, and then there was a period in which medicine became a practice practiced by men. Did things begin to change? Did that have an impact on how we view abortion?
Well, as Leslie already said, the first campaign to criminalize abortion was led by physicians who were concerned that so many non-physicians were performing various obstetrical services, deliveries, and abortions. But I don't think the medicalization is the issue.
No.
I mean, today the vast majority of OBGYNs are women. States where it's permitted, women nurse midwives and physician assistants are performing early abortions. The medicalization of abortion, in my view, is a good thing. Because when women try to do it themselves, as happened to a great extent before Roe, and now we're seeing incidents of it happening again. For many women, it might as well be in the pre-Roe era now. So we're seeing women, especially young women, taking matters into their own hands. I don't think that's a good thing. So I think abortion is one part of the spectrum of reproductive health care.
Yes.
And the fact that it's in the medical system, I think, is a good thing.
Now, we'll close out, and I only have about a half a minute left or a minute or so. Back to the zigzag, do you see a reversal in this pattern? Are things going to change, or are we staying on this current trajectory for a while to come?
Well, I think ultimately, who knows how long we will be in this extremely repressive cycle. But I do think ultimately it will change again. The reason it was legalized was because of the oppressiveness of the criminalization of abortion. And that came from women who were experiencing the horrors of self-induced abortion. There were 5,000 women a year coming into the emergency ward in Chicago's public hospital from injuries and bleeding. There were women dying. And from the medical profession who were seeing it in public health. So that's happening. It will happen. So those experiences are likely to bring a revolt.
I want to thank both of you for being on the program today. Carol Joffe, professor in the Bixby Center for Global Reproductive Health at the University of California, San Francisco, author of the book Dispatches from the Abortion Wars, The Cost of Fanaticism to Doctors, Patients, and the Rest of Us. Leslie Regan is a professor of history at the University of Illinois and the author of the book When Abortion Was a Crime, Women, Medicine, and the Law in the United States, 1967 to 1973. Thank you both for being on the program.
Thank
Thanks.
You.
And thank you for listening to The State of Things. You can find us on the web at stateofthings.org and on Facebook as well. This is North Carolina Public Radio. It's a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.